Welcome to This Is Your Afterlife, conversations with artists and activists about death and life. I'm Dave Marr. I'm a comedian. I live in Chicago. 9 years ago, I was in a coma, and this is the show. My guest this week is Chris Jussel. I'm happy to report that it is complete, the Fubutsushi collection. If you have listened to the show for any length of time, you know that Fubutsushi is the ambient jazz band whose four seasonal albums, I believe starting in 2020 through 2021, helped get me through lockdown. They mean a lot to me. Many of them have become my friends. The four members, Matt Sage, Patrick Shiroishi, Chaz Primack, and now Chris Jussel, who plays violin in the band. I've interviewed all of them. Chaz, as Lake Mary, provides all the music for this episode and all the episodes going forward. And, you know, as with any group of four, you get to kind of pick which one you are. And for a long time, I thought, oh, I'm probably a Sage, you know, and now I'm not sure. Chris and I had a very fun, wide-ranging, going down a lot of rabbit holes, caveats on caveats conversation. We think similarly, I believe. And it made for just a really fun talk. A couple of things to know. So if you go on Patreon, which I'm so grateful for the folks who support the show that way, you can do so for as little as $5 a month. It helps me keep making the show. Always you get the full conversation that I recorded. The main feed is edited down a little bit. But one thing that was not recorded this time is the first hour of our conversation was just getting to know each other and talking about various Real Housewives franchises. You'll hear the reference to that at the end of this episode. I think it's contextualized enough that you don't need to have seen the show, but or you know, any of the shows. But that's not recorded. So that is just that's lost to the ether. I think that's fine. If you are on Patreon or if you listen to the show and you're like, dude, I want this content, let me know. I'm available to start recording that. Also, I did leave in Chris attempting to hijack the show and turn it into Las Culturistas. In general, this conversation does get meta in points. And while I do not leave it as completely unedited as last week with Jeffrey Cantu Ledesma, I do allow us to go down some rabbit holes because it felt true to the spirit of this conversation. In the show notes this week, I have included where you can find Chris's music, especially with Fubutsushi. I have also once again included a link to Chicago Abortion Fund's Fundathon, my page, along with my partner Hope, and would love if you donated there. Would love if you signed on to the link to support the Living Wage for Musicians Act. So that's what I've got. Thank you so much for listening. Here is my wonderfully spirited conversation with Chris Jussel.
Also, yeah, because it makes you really horny to think about defunding the police.
Sure.
Yeah, it makes me horny. It makes me horny as hell.
Okay, paint your hell. Speaking of hell, Chris.
Okay,
we gotta start the podcast.
So something it seems like we have in common, and this is from our messaging and now in-person conversation. I think we have in common that we are pretty anxious people that overthink things way too much, right? So like, I spend all day overthinking stuff, assuming that when I had an unsuccessful reaction with another human being, that they were hating me before I even got there. So I think the like hell, I know Chaz said something like his hell would be people telling him that they're disappointed in him. And I think like I have gotten to the point, luckily, as in close to 40-year-old, where I value clear communication. And as wounding as it could be in the moment, it always ends up feeling good. Like if you have enough experiences where communication feels healthy and good, even when it's tough at first, you grow to just be like, oh, yeah, I'd rather someone say they're disappointed. I think my hell would be people being vibey all the time, just like people being sort of off in this way where they seem like disappointed, or they seem annoyed or uninterested, or any basket of negative things. But like, I also spend a fair amount of time worrying about my physical attractiveness, which is a weird thing that I would love to. I have talked to a therapist about all the stuff, all the aforementioned things, but that's another thing, is like, we were talking about rejection and a little, well, before the episode of this podcast, hello, everyone, yeah, we were talking about like that notion of auditioning for something or putting yourself out there, sending out a question and rejected. Right. Like, you know, I'm a gay person. I am on Grindr sometimes. And so the idea of rejection and like somebody not liking a certain aspect of you, and sometimes it's your literal face online, is really weird and tough. And there are days where I'm like, oh, well, that's insane, or that's, you know, really stupid and I don't care. And then there are days where it is the thing that feels like it matters the most to me. So I guess
because Grindr, my understanding of it is that it is a map,
yeah,
with like the face is, or whatever your profile picture is,
yeah,
like populates on the map itself. So
it's not a map as much, it's just a grid. It's like an endless grid that like the people closest to you are the ones, the people that show up at the most top left are the ones closest to you, but you don't know in what direction they are from you. Do you know what I mean? Like there is a different app that is a literal map populated by mostly genitalia rather than faces, but that's a different app. But anyway, it's just like, I don't know. Is that an adequate answer? Is the fact that I'm asking if that's an adequate answer enough of a revealing thing about me?
No, I mean, people have worries about adequate answers a lot.
Yeah.
I don't think you have to be particularly like overthinky for that.
Yeah.
But I think the thing I'm wondering is, would it be more hellish to ask people if they were disinterested, bored, whatever, and have them give you an unsatisfactory answer to go like, oh no, that must have just been my face was just, I don't really remember exactly what you're talking about, but
yeah,
probably my face was just doing that or something, but you don't believe them really. Is that more hellish, or is it just the sort of cesspool of not knowing at all?
I think it's the cesspool of not knowing. I adopt your phrasing and will say it that way. It's the cesspool of not knowing. I think I'm pretty comfortable. I certainly am not like a confrontational person, and I tend not to ask people things like, were you mad at me? Or like, because I think the question, are you mad at me, is one of life's greatest hells in itself. It's like,
God, that's so real.
Getting a text from somebody that says, are you mad at me? Is like, oh my God, I would rather literally die than respond to a text like that.
I'm realizing I just sent texts like that without, but it worded differently,
it super
but
depends to a on friend. The context. Yeah.
No, but I think what you're saying is, I'm like, man, I really, because even it's hell for everyone. Asking, are you mad at me, is horrible.
Yeah.
Being asked, are you mad at me? It also is a question that immediately sets an affirmative answer into action by it being asked.
Absolutely. Instead of starting with a position of like, hey, I've been feeling like we haven't seen each other much, or we've been distant, or I felt kind of weird the last couple times we hung out, and I'm wondering if you felt that, or if there's anything we should talk about. You know what I mean? Approaching it from that angle. Which is, that's the way
people aren't used to. Well, people aren't used to having those negotiations around friendships.
No.
I think.
No, it's tough.
Like, it's like, whoa, this is too much work. This is what I say for my romantic relationship.
And honestly, it's a little bit maybe like sex in that way, where if something's even slightly off, it can really sort of just turn into a slippery slope down to like, it's a failure. And if it, the thing that's slightly off, it's like, there's some way to say this maybe that is from something, but like when you turn your gaze directly upon the thing, it becomes really like mortifying or something.
So right.
If you're like, hey, you lost your boner, are you not interested? Suddenly it's like, whoa, like why are you talking about that? We're supposed to obliquely reference these things and not actually engage with them directly.
What do you hope happens when you die?
Wait, is there a separate question? What do I think happens when we die? Or is it just, what do I hope?
No, that's okay. Listen, you're telling me, oh, you did so much research.
You start changing.
You are hijacking my podcast to turn it into another successful podcast that exists with the I Don't Think So, Honey.
Ooh, this is, it's a hybrid.
Yeah. No, I, what do you hope happens if you have, you know, if you'd rather, that's just my way of like circumventing, a conversation ending atheist.
Okay. Answer. Okay. That's nice. I like your motive for that.
Thank you.
I really like this podcast. I really like this podcast and I really like my effort to ruin it in this, being on it. I hope
you can't ruin it.
That we it's too big to fail. I hope that we I hope that heaven exists, and I hope that I get to live in heaven forever.
You hope that like Christian heaven exists.
I hope no. I hate Christianity. I hate it so much. No, I hope that each individual person's version, I don't know. Then it gets so complicated. This is part of the reason I don't even believe in it, is that I think like, if you're like, what is Christian heaven versus other religion heaven versus each individual person's idea of heaven? It's like, well, how can this possibly?
Well, what's your heaven?
My heaven, I guess, would just be getting to, it would just be all day sex. I guess my version of it. It's just chicken tenders alternating with sex, alternating with watching Salt Lake City. There's always a new episode of Salt Lake City each day.
Amazing. That's a great. See, this is the thing. Like, we can talk abstractly about these things. We can say very like moving, spiritual, not even platitudes, actual truths.
Yeah.
But chicken tenders, Salt Lake City, sex, heaven is. The concreteness of that is very satisfying.
That is for sure a Red Hot Chili Peppers album title. Chaz is gonna love that.
Yeah.
Wait, what was that one more time? Salt Lake City chicken. You said, chicken tender, you said, Salt Lake City sex heaven.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's good. Yeah. That's really good.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's like it sort of just turns into the question of like, what's your favorite stuff to do? Right? Like, what's your...
Sure, sure.
And I think there are thoughtful people that would say being on the best hike, would be heaven or whatever, but like what activity does anyone enjoy enough besides prayer to do it infinitely for the rest of eternity? If you had to pick one activity, is there one thing?
Well,
you would
that's
do?
The risk is like the problem of heaven, of eternity, is boredom.
Yeah. Right. Right.
So how do you circumvent that?
How do you
so it
variety?
Sounds like for you variety, right?
Heaven is variety. Oh yeah. And even professionally, it's like I sometimes tend to say things that as if everybody already agrees with me. It's like, well, we all like variety, right? And there are people that are like, no, I don't want variety, I want a routine.
Right.
I for sure need variety. That concept of the funnel, where as you get older you have to funnel down into smaller and smaller bags of like, what do you do? It's like specialization, I guess, is another way to talk about it. If you don't want to say funnel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does the word just, funnel gross you out?
No, it doesn't gross me. It makes me sad.
Yeah.
I think of it as like, yeah, but like also bags too. It feels like all your...
Bags was a weird word. I don't know why I talked about
it. It becomes
bags,
colostomy.
Yeah, that's gross.
It becomes colostomic.
Yeah,
just
that
like
combination.
Your interests are a bag of shit relating to
bag
TV. Bag of shit relating to your church that you go to.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah. Also, the combination of funnel and bags makes me think of a goose that's being fed to, what is that meat?
Oh,
foie gras.
Yeah.
Poor things. Quack, quack, quack. Yeah. But the funnel is like, I have really tried to resist funnel and like specialization and being, and that thing of like, no, I still would like to have hobbies that I spend almost as much time on as my profession.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
So,
And I think the reason that relates to age and growing up in quotes is that people take on the responsibilities of homeownership,
yeah,
or having kids, or are forced into the responsibilities of taking care of, you know, elderly family members,
yeah,
or just sickness and disease become a bigger part of your life or whatever.
Totally.
So like these things, you know, it's so, I have like parent friends, a buddy who like he and his wife just got pregnant, and our other parent friends are like, get used to never seeing the end of a movie again, you know? And I'm like, I totally get that. And these aren't like shitty dudes.
Right.
These are like people I met in like creative fields,
yeah,
you know, who are like interested in expanding their horizons, being active in their communities. And still they're like with not shitting on their kids, but being like, this does the funnel.
Yeah. Thing. I talked to Matt Sage about this, maybe it was right after they had had their son. But that idea of like, there are people, yeah, people complain about their kids all day long, be like, oh, that's the hardest thing I've ever done. But then they also do a thing that I get upset about sometimes, where they're like, it's also the most meaningful thing I've ever done. And I never knew this depth of love until I did this. And my life, you know, you can take it to this grotesque extent where it's like, my life had no meaning until I did this. And like, I thought that I was doing interesting things, and then I had a child and I realized your childless life is meaningless garbage. And you know, it's really easy to take that as a person, not a gay person, but a person who doesn't specifically want to have kids, like probably ever, and just be like, okay, but I do think my life has meaning. And I think that as we barrel towards death, that meaning is just, you know, what does it even mean? But you're just trying to have a good life. And I don't want to have a kid, and I don't need to feel your judgment, not talking to Matt in this instance. I haven't felt judged by him about kid stuff, but like, I don't need to feel anyone's judgment about not having a kid or wanting to have a kid, or even necessarily wanting to be forced to engage with other people having kids. So it's like, if I'm at a restaurant and I'm sitting at a table, and the table next to me has that baby that keeps staring back at me and smiling, and the parents are like, oh my gosh, he likes you. I'm like, sometimes I'm going to engage with that and be like, that's cute. That baby's cute. That's not one of the ugly ones. But like other times I'll be
like,
but
this is still a stranger that you don't necessarily feel like engaging with.
And you having a kid doesn't mean that my life, that I have to think it's important that you had a kid, or that your child is alive and beautiful and special in this, on this earth, you know?
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, maybe we just have slightly different, maybe we disagree about this a little bit, but for me, I'm like, I do want to say that I think it's important that they had a kid or something,
because
but I don't,
it's working for them.
I don't know. Just that like it's cool.
Yeah.
I, you know, and I don't know where I stand on kids. So to be honest, I might be in a position where, where I'm forced into it by like external circumstances, you know, of like age and finances, and that just decides it.
Sure.
You know? But I do have worked with kids.
Yeah.
I enjoy kids.
Me too.
I have, but I also understand like not, I think it's really important to like not talk to kids in baby voices.
Yes.
To treat them like people.
Yes.
To like honor their, you know, politically and emotionally, their like desires and their thoughts,
like independence.
But also that means that means like treating them like a person.
Yeah.
So like a person who would just be like staring at you at a restaurant, like not to be like cartoony, but like there, I guess there's a way that could be charming, but you know, you
they'd
often would
be
just
hot.
Be like,
they'd have to be hot.
Yeah. Like, are they on the grid?
Yeah.
But no, like it's different because babies aren't like their brains aren't fully developed or whatever. What am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that there is a that having kids serves a really crucial role in society.
Oh, yeah.
And that it is not the only role to be filled.
Totally.
And I think a lot of parents are aware of that.
Yeah.
But the mainstream traditional interpretation is, no, this is the most important. This is the role of parent is prioritized over a role of, there's so many,
almost everything else.
Yeah.
Like, and
yes, yes,
innocence exactly. of childhood is prioritized as a societal value and like a religious one, it, with mm-hmm. emphasis on the religious mm-hmm. part of that, where it's like it, when, you know, we're seeing it with everything that's happening on planet Earth right now, when children die, somehow that is like a new level of transgression of human behavior mm-hmm. that's sort of like worthy of enacting laws over and starting wars over and whatever. So right. like, yeah.
Right.
Except with for when like, they're dying by gun violence in America and then we won't do any goddamn thing about it.
Yeah. The way in which, to put a fine point on it, because I don't mind, like, with the genocide in Palestine mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that like it dehumanizes Palestinian men
exactly
to have like and this many women and children. It's like, no, these are all lives totally. That are what I'm saying is all lives matter.
What
you
I guess
know?
We're
and
saying
I think
on this podcast, and I hope that everyone's listening loud and clear. Oh, I can't even say it. But like, no, listen, when the art, I don't even, I shouldn't, when the Titanic went down in the okay. frigid Atlantic yes. and they yes. saved women and children first, I said, no, no, no. I said, don't you dare.
You well, see, well, then that's a different, I now I'm like, well, what, how do you even do that? I think you do have to go children first, because you almost just in a fairness of life. Like,
yeah, because they'll be able to paddle the boat through the icebergs.
Well, no,
with their little spaghetti arms.
I'm just thinking in terms of, well, even if I'm only 30, you're 11. I got to have 19 more years.
Yeah,
if
but this that, is the, that thing of yeah. the promise of the amount of life you have left is
yeah
false. It's like
totally also it's not like no one as the Titanic was sinking was being like, let's think about this mathematically, like this needs to be
no
what we really need to come to a logical way of doing
yeah
this.
Well, they were trying yeah. to, and then the thing split in half. You remember that part of the movie, that documentary that we all
yeah,
watched with
yeah.
Kate Winslet?
Mm-hmm.
The they were trying to be mathematical, and then the boat split in half, and then they were like, well, shit, I guess we gotta like just panic.
Exactly.
Except for the string yeah. quartet, to take it back to my profession, where those guys just kept playing.
You wouldn't do that.
The
you?
Amount of times that I think about and talk about the movie Titanic and also the franchise Harry Potter is shocking. Like that concept of monoculture where this stuff is just like always on your mind. I know your yeah. your things probably aren't Titanic and Harry Potter, but
yeah, what would they be? I mean, my recent thing is Survivor.
Oh.
But my thing with monoculture is like having spent so much time intentionally sidestepping it
yeah.
and being taking pride in like obscure subculture,
yeah.
you know?
Fucking hipster.
Yeah, right. When I get into, in addition to Survivor, I don't know if I'm fully caught up with like the newest season, but have watched every episode of Grey's Anatomy.
Whoa.
And that to me feels like not really, but some part of me feels like that's inherently very interesting, that the way in which I'm engaging with this incredibly popular show, because I also like all the Fubut Sushi records.
You're a smart
you know
person
what I mean?
Who appreciates
yeah.
the pinnacle of art, which is my band.
I get this on a deeper level. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
Do you have funeral plans?
Oh, just to like go right back to the podcast, huh?
I
don't, although my brother, I have two younger brothers. One of them just visited last weekend, and we were talking about this, not because of this podcast, but just like they were like, what do you want to happen when you die with your body? And I want the thing that takes the least amount of effort on someone else's part and contributes to changing the world the least to happen. So like, if that means the thing I said to my brother was, ideally, I would be tossed off of a boat into the ocean and just consumed by fish. Like,
sure.
Or burned in some fire that's already burning and
tossed in.
I don't want to be, I would love to be cremated as compared to being buried, just because I would take up less space after. But then you think about like how much energy the cremation, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So all of that, it's like, I just want to, I want to bother people the least. So if it tossed me into the ocean, or just like, you know, society is declining anyway, so maybe just leave me wherever I am and it'll be fine.
Sure. Leave me behind in the trek to find water.
Exactly. But yeah, please leave me. But like, you know, I think the water is a good, you're gonna decay, you're gonna etc. I don't want to be buried, and cremated is fine, but I also don't want to be in an urn on someone's bookshelf that has taken on some meaning. Wait, what's your answer to this question? What do you want to happen when you die? Or I'm sorry, what do you want to happen to your body, funeral plans wise?
At this point, I think to me, I think just like wood box.
Okay.
Like if that's allowed, like wood box
in the ground.
I guess now you're making me rethink
the
ground.
I think you laid it out
as a moral sort of situation.
Well, there's plenty of space out there, right? It's like at the same time that there are too many people.
That's the thing they say about the world, is there's plenty of space. No one's having any issues with
the
space.
The thing they say about the world is, come on in. But I don't think it's a moral thing for me, the being buried thing. I think I just don't want somebody to have to dig a hole, even if it's with a machine. And I don't want to
But if your answer is boat, you're making someone charter a boat and go out far enough that your body's not going to wind up on shore.
The thing about boats is I really don't understand them outside of they split in half if they hit an iceberg. And so as far as chartering, see, it's always with us. As far as chartering a boat, I don't know what that means. I mean, I know it means somebody's got to do it, but like.
Yeah, you have to pay money.
I'm dead. Somehow. I'm not paying anybody.
But I thought you were trying to make this easy on
people. Well, I don't. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? I just want to not. If that means like being tossed off of a cliff even, but then somebody's got to do the tossing. That's what I say that so many times a week. Somebody's got to do the tossing.
Where does this cliff? Do you have other aspects of a funeral?
Yeah.
That
yes.
You would.
Again, my brother visited, and his wife is, her parents are Irish people, like live in Ireland. And they have a thing she told me about where when somebody dies and they're an old person, so it's a planned thing, they've sort of like left some money at a pub so that everybody can go to that pub after they die and have a party on them. So I like that idea a lot. It's something that's not, I don't want a funeral, certainly not in a church, duh. But like I don't, if you can't hear my voice or what I've said about Christianity so far, but I like the idea of somebody being nice and being like, oh, we liked when he did that. And one time he said that thing and that was pretty funny. But otherwise, I don't want a memorial service with people playing music even. Because I think
really?
I just want to take up less space all the time, which is bad. But if people play music, if they're like, here is his favorite song, and then it's Hey by Usher, they're...
Is that your favorite song?
And it's not. It's not. I liked it when he did it at the Super Bowl, but there were other reasons I liked that performance.
Sure.
His abs.
Is there a way, like, okay, if you say, I always want to take up less space.
Yeah.
And then say, and that's so bad.
Yeah.
If you really thought it was so bad, or I realize there's a difference between like thought and action, mm-hmm. but there must be something about not like What is the value for you behind not taking up space?
Well, I think, and herein we reach the crux of what I should be talking about in therapy, which is like, it's completely disingenuous to say that I want to take up less space. I want people to think about me. I want people to think I'm attractive. I want people to think I'm talented. I want people to come to my performances and watch me play music and listen to me play music. But more importantly, watch me play music. And all of these things, all of these things require people thinking about me, which is the opposite of not taking up space. So it's like, there is a friction there where like, I used to want to take up less space and I've gotten better about it, but
it sounds like just a shame thing.
I think so. It's one of those things we were talking about with like nested anxiety, nested caveating, where it's like, I get so annoyed at my own urge to want to take up less space. And then the direct conflict that like the hypocrisy that comes out when I immediately reveal that I do want to take up space and be thought about and have people think I'm special. Those things are so annoying in unison that I'm just sort of like, oh my God, I am so annoying and gross. Like, just take me out of here. And then
you're just like vibrating with like, I don't know the science, but like two poles of things, a thing that's not drawn to either. It's just like in the middle, just like vibrating between these two impulses, you know, it's that it can't be still, but it's not all the way to one or the other. You're just like have magnets like on either side of a little metal cylinder that's just like on its stand going like,
yeah. And you're right. Yeah. That's really attractive. And I am single. So if anybody out there hears what Dave just said and is like, yeah, that's hot. My inbox is open, as they say.
You know the relive one memory prompt if you've listened to the podcast.
Yeah.
It's just the idea that there's an afterlife where everyone has the opportunity to pick a single memory that they can relive in a particularly vivid way whenever they want, but you have to choose one.
Yeah.
What would you choose?
At the risk of over tangenting and just sort of having an explanation for everything, I did want to talk about one person in my life who died, which was my grandmother, and something that happened when she died, and maybe that will get me to answer the question you just asked. So both my parents had parents. Whoa. But I was really close with my mom's parents, and all my grandparents are dead now, but my mom's mom died first, and it was when I was a freshman in college. So this was like 2003, and we were super, super close. I was the oldest of three boys, and I just spent all my time with my grandparents, but especially my grandmother, while my mom was at work when I was younger. This was in Virginia. And so I would sit at my grandparents' house with my grandmother on the couch in their living room, watching TV all day long. She had macular degeneration, which is like where your vision goes bad from the inside out. So it starts with like a gray spot in the middle of your vision and then gets bigger from there, spreads out. So by the time I was a kid, her vision was pretty bad, but she would sit and I guess mostly just like listen to TV and movies, but watching them or whatever. But I'd sit there and we'd hold hands all day and she'd smoke cigarettes all day long. And so like none of this is ideal, but it was the 90s.
What kind of cigarettes?
I think they were Marlboros, but I don't know what kind of Marlboros.
Yeah.
It was like whatever. She would hold my hand and watch TV. And it was like this very sweet thing in hindsight. And at the time, I was never like, this sucks. I was like, a gay child who was happily sitting and holding his grandmother's hand all day long at the age of five and six. But she died when I was a freshman in college. And when she died, she smoked all the time. Her health had been getting kind of bad or whatever, but she wasn't 90 years old or anything. But the morning that she died, I had woken up and then gone back to sleep. With that thing where you wake up at 4 or 5 a.m. and then go back to sleep and sleep a couple more hours. we've all had the experience where that happens. And often I'm assuming, if you've had that experience, that you've also had the experience where you have sometimes a dream and sometimes a more vivid dream or a lucid dream. And I think those are, I read about it at some point a long time ago, but those are like, there's an increased chance of those when you do that thing where you like go back to sleep after.
On the back end?
Yeah. Where you wake up
okay.
early in the morning and then go back to sleep for an amount of time. There's like an increased chance of having a lucid dream. I think that that's true. It's been a long time since I looked into that.
I didn't know that.
But that happened that morning. And when I went back to sleep and had a dream, it was a really vivid dream of my grandmother. So it was her and I sitting across from each other in a room, like a light colored room. I would say white room, but that sounds cliche. And we were surrounded by my family. So like my mom and dad and brothers and my mom's sister, my grandmother's other daughter, and her kids. And so they were all sort of blurry, but my grandmother and I were in focus facing each other. And she was crying in this dream. And she was asking me to teach her how to play the violin. And that's essentially the dream. Is like, I still have that image really clear to me in the way that like most dream stuff isn't, like after a certain amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like that's super clear to me. And the image of her crying, asking me to teach her how to play the violin, our family surrounding us, not saying anything or whatever, but like, and then I woke up, thought about that being sort of a strange dream. Cause besides that, I like didn't even dream about my grandparents like ever. I was in college, you know?
Yeah.
And I got the call at like 9 a.m. after, or yeah, like 9 a.m. after, I think I probably woke up from that dream at 7-ish and then had to go to some early class or something. And I got the call at 9 a.m. Yeah. that she had died. So I feel very strongly, not that there is an afterlife or not that that was like a religious experience, but just that like on the way out of this life, whatever electrical connection we had or that we all have or whatever, that she like chose me or was maybe even having that dream as she died, which really fucks me up to think about, but that she somehow like chose to visit me or think about me, and that it was so strong as her life was extinguished that I like perceived it and received that visit. And that feeling of like meaning in that, of like being connected to her in that moment, is maybe like my favorite feeling I've ever felt. So like in a really roundabout way, then to get back to the idea of like a memory, I have lots of memories with friends that I have lots of memories with friends that I've really loved, but I don't think that there's anything specific that I could pick that would be like, that's the one moment. Like I listened to Matt's episode where he talked about the rain in the woods thing with Lynette. And that's really beautiful. But like, I think to not have a relationship currently where I'm like, oh my God, it's just all these moments. But the pinnacle of the moments is that one. It's like, I think back to the moment with my grandmother that morning that she died, assuming that there was some sort of intent or whatever in her being connected to me mentally in that moment, that's the feeling I would choose.
The pleasant aspect of the feeling happen when you woke up before you found out that she had died?
No, because the dream was pretty sad. Like her crying and
it sounds sad. Right?
It was sad. And then finding out that she died, of course, was sort of like, it was really sad. And I think devastating is a fine word for it. Cause my life hasn't been very touched by death. Like Chaz has had so many people close to him die. And I know a lot of people have, but I haven't really had any, I've had no best friends die to speak of, or like, you know, my parents are both alive. My siblings are alive. My cousins are alive, like that kind of thing. So like besides grandparents and the fact that I play in orchestras, and at any given moment, there are 70 people employed by an orchestra of varying ages. And sometimes they die, is like, that sort of thing has happened. But I don't know, that dream has grown over time, but I think it happened kind of quickly, but like to achieve some sort of importance to me that felt very like loving and meaningful.
So is it a feeling that you still have and tap into?
I mean, it's a feeling that makes me tear up anytime I think about it or talk about it, but it is that feeling of like being chosen. That sounds kind of gross to phrase it that way, but it is that feeling of like,
no.
I guess, again, intimacy, like meaningful connection, where it's like, I felt so lucky, grateful, not privileged, but like, yeah, chosen. But I guess I always felt so safe with those grandparents too. Like there is a really specific memory, and I must have been younger than 10 because we moved away from Virginia when I was 10. But I was with my grandparents, maybe one of my younger brothers too. Middle of the day, my parents are at work and we're at Wendy's. And I remember so clearly the feeling of taking a bite of a Wendy's cheeseburger. And they are sponsoring this episode. Thank you so much, Wendy's.
Yes, thank you.
Wendy's cheeseburger. And having it taste so delicious to my 8-year-old self. And looking around and like the light was perfect. And my grandparents were there and we were happy. And I remember thinking like we were going to be with them for like a day or two. And I remember thinking into the future enough to be like, oh, now it's a feeling I recognize as I don't have work tomorrow. Like that feeling of when you are having a day and you remember that you don't have work the next day and you calm down, like that feeling of being happy and calm and having just bitten into a signature Wendy's single, Dave's Classic, was really, which I think tastes more of mustard than it does of ketchup, which I think is sort of Wendy's secret. Besides the fact that it's a square patty.
That's big. Yeah.
But it
felt fresher at a time, so too. Wendy's like, felt like they were fresher than McDonald's.
It is the target. Wendy's is the target of fast food in a way that, like, that's probably not true. There's lots of other examples. But Wendy's is Target and McDonald's is Walmart.
Sure. Say more.
There are too many fast foods out there, so you could. This would be an interesting experiment, I think, to me. But like, you feel like Wendy's is a little nicer. It's just like a little nicer and a little better for you, and you're kind of like a better person because you went to a Wendy's.
It's definitely not better for you anymore. But I was thinking of is given you what I'm a year or two older than you,
and I'm 38.
And the age I'm 39.
Cool.
So the age you were when you ate this, I know the architecture of Wendy's because they were all the same at this time.
Yeah.
And there was definitely a salad bar.
Yes, sure.
And so at that time, Wendy's was healthier. Or felt there were like tangible things you could point to. I don't think McDonald's had even introduced like salads.
I don't or something. Yeah. Well,
like
the notion of
maybe they always had
McDonald's salad is so like what even is in it?
I remember when they had the salad shakers. Do you remember when those were introduced?
Yes.
I got very into like around when I graduated high school. I think there was like 2 weeks when I got really into the McDonald's Caesar salad shakers. Yeah. It's because a Caesar salad is like not even a salad. It's like a nice little thing. And it made so much sense. I was never a salad person.
A Caesar salad is not a salad.
No, yeah. But I remember feeling like, this is brilliant. You like completely coat the salad in the thing.
Yeah.
You shake it up. Like,
I've never stopped shaking salad since then.
Right. Exactly. It transformed a whole generation.
It taught me to live. Yeah.
Yeah. But no work tomorrow. I don't have work tomorrow
that
as
feeling.
You bite into this hamburger.
But if I had to pick a specific memory, it was just having bitten into that Wendy's cheeseburger, thinking about the fact that I got to hang out with my grandparents for at least another day and just feeling like everything is fine into infinity. Because it's sort of impossible to think about longer than the next like day, right? So you can talk about next month or next year or whatever, but like it's that thing where your brain can't really conceive of a number higher than 100. Like you can, the concept of 1,000 or 10,000 is fine, but if you try to picture it, you can't really do it. So like
the converse of the feeling that you're talking about, which I thought you were going to say when you're like, I had this like ideal moment. And then I remembered that we were going to be done, that we were going home in an hour or something like that is, and that's a feeling that like, I remember specifically in high school band, like we would go on these trips. It was probably when we went down, we were in Cincinnati. So went down on a bus to Mardi Gras to play in one of the parades.
Okay.
And all the crazy experiences and being with good friends and then pulling back into the school parking lot and the feeling of like, oh man, this is like over.
Yeah.
Like this is a Sunday. We have school on Monday and this whole thing is just done. It is the like, and that is such a deep existential sadness.
Absolutely.
To me.
End of vacation. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Tinged with some beauty though. Mm-hmm.
But you had a good time. Yeah.
Yeah. But the everything's fine to infinity is like the opposite of that in such a also way that I can tap into even and feel calm from it.
Yeah. And something I've learned from therapy, shout out to Liz in Boulder, Colorado. Thank you so much, Liz. she's wonderful. And she's an ardent follower of your podcast. But something we've talked about is the notion of safety. And I think safety is one of those words that can feel so dramatic and annoying when you talk about it in situations that aren't like literally you're not aflame at the moment. So you're safe.
Sure.
Is like something I've learned to appreciate. Every human has a different experience and every gay person has a different experience, but I just didn't feel safe a lot when I was a kid. And it wasn't because anybody was hitting me or I just, for various reasons, didn't feel safe. It felt like I was always about to be kicked out of wherever I was. And again, it's not because my parents told me they were going to kick me out. I just had the feeling. Mm-hmm. So I think those moments of like that Wendy's moment was a feeling of safety. That's like how I can label it. And that was like, in this moment, I am safe and I will be safe for an amount of time that I don't need to worry about. So like that feeling into infinity is like deeper than I'm having a nice time on this vacation to Paris, Texas. But like, you know, it was just sort of like, I am safe. And that, I guess, to keep revising earlier answers, heaven would also be someplace that really feels safe. That's like not tinged with, I don't need a variety of safety. I'll say that when it comes to variety, I do not want a variety of safety. Anxiety causes me to experience a variety of safety all the time, all the live long day, do-da-do-da. But like I would prefer to have safety feel constant, mental safety, physical safety, and like emotional safety.
The last big question is what's your coma?
Yeah.
Which is just a moment of transformation where before you were one version of yourself and after you were another. Does not have to be as dramatic as my coma.
Yeah.
Literal coma. And it's metaphorical. It's truly whatever you want it to be.
Yeah. So this is the one I thought about the most and crawled up the most into inside of my own Ouroboros and a stupid brain thing. But like, don't have one moment. It is, this question made me think of the concept that I thought about again, at the risk of being like, I'm gay and that means I'm special. But like, I think there is a thing. The famous podcaster and journalist, Dan Savage, who used to write in Seattle. He has like a sex advice column that was super popular. Maybe he's still doing it, but Savage Love. But he would talk about this concept of your brain, and he meant specifically as a gay man, but like your brain being at different levels of maturity. So different parts of your brain being at different things. So if you're a straight person, often you're going to start dating and kissing chicks and dating when you're like in junior high or whatever. But if you're gay and a specific kind of gay person that's being taught, you know, by society that it's not good and it's not right, you're not going to do those things. So like you don't experience a breakup until much later than a lot of other people. And you don't experience like rejection dating wise until much later. A lot of this is dating related, I guess. But I thought it was so interesting. And I think about this a lot still. And I really like to talk to people about it because I think it exists within everyone. Like these things, except maybe in like the most cliche football quarterback bro that drives a Mustang convertible is like maybe his brain is doing like the ideal version of everything happened at the right time.
Right.
But like I bet he has his own insecurities. But I think for me that idea of not having a coma is sort of like there are big moments in my life where like my grandmother died or I came out as a gay person. But even that is like, I didn't come out to everybody at once. I wasn't Ellen DeGeneres on the cover of People magazine.
Well, let me ask you this, because the other aspect of the question is about change.
Yeah.
Is about the change to you rather than just the external thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, are you struggling to identify a moment, which by the way, a moment doesn't have to be a split second. A moment can be years, you know, but,
some people wait a lifetime for a moment like this.
That it's exactly right.
Yeah.
And so is a moment. Also, can I just say, because this is a thing that I've done on the podcast before, and it's a note I give to myself while recording sometimes, that I'm like, this is a thing you should work on to be a better host, is I will do that like laugh to like and I know of the like where but it's because I actually think it's funny, and the reason I'm doing it is not to dismiss you, it is rather to clue the listener in that was a moment that they should identify as a moment of comedy. So I just want to say that, because this feels like the conversation where I should speak to that.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I hadn't even noticed, but now I'm going to be insecure about it. Please.
Okay. Well, that's not the point. The point is rather the opposite, that like, hey, Chris is saying a funny thing. You should notice that was ironic. You know?
Good luck.
The point being that, and that laugh was sincere, actually, do you feel like you've not changed at all? Like, does some part of you feel essentially the same from birth?
No.
Okay. Well, so in what ways do you feel different, and what experiences have, or what's one way you felt different, and what experience or process led to that?
Oh, you know what? Actually, thanks for being a really thoughtful person and a good podcast host.
You're welcome.
I do not feel the same. I feel much taller than I was when I was born, and I feel much smarter and more interested in different things. Okay, so I think I'm really interested in self-improvement, and I think I'm a very curious person. So maybe, actually, a good dividing line is like when I started therapy in 2020 during COVID, when every other person started therapy. But like, I started therapy because I was having doubts about my relationship. And I thought that if I started seeing a therapist, I could present her with a set of facts and just be like, tell me what to do. Mm. And I found out quickly that that is not therapy, that she was like, well, I can help you try to make a decision, but I can't tell you what to do. Like, all I can do is sort of, well, she never put it this way, but I started to think about it in this way that Stephen King talks about writing, which is that he has a set of tools in a toolbox.
Yeah.
And like, how much does he use those different tools? And what tools are appropriate for what aspects? But like, I think of therapy as, I don't see her, I haven't seen her in a while now, but it was pretty constant for 3 years. And I feel like I really developed a box of tools from therapy that I approach situations with very differently now. So like, I think when things happen to me that happened to me before therapy, I think about them differently or more patiently or more progressively or whatever it is. There are people in my life that might just be like, no, dude, we do not notice a difference. You think that you're some evolved person and you're not. But I think in my own head that I am a different person.
And what are those ways of evaluating situations?
I think a lot of it has to do with patience. And I think a lot of it has to do with self-awareness when it comes to safety and, what's that stupid quote? Is it a literal quote from the Bible? Like, God grant me the wisdom to expect.
The serenity prayer. Well, having discussed the fact that I was in recovery, I would call it less a stupid quote and more a foundational tenet of perhaps my belief system. But it's grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage. No. It's, you know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
To know the difference. Okay.
Serenity, courage, wisdom.
So that idiotic quote is something that I'm so sorry. I'm just kidding.
Thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a real pleasure. And that's all the time that we have.
Yeah.
For
oh, my episode. Internet is breaking up. Yeah. I'm going through a tunnel. But no, I only say that because it's one of those things.
It's truly okay. I am not. You know, even if you're like, no, I'm going to end this.
No, but you know what's funny? The only reason I call it stupid is that it is a cliche quote, not because the message is meaningful. I mean, the reason that it came up in my mind is that it is, it literally has a message that's important, the same way that Live, Laugh, Love does, right? It's like, I do want to be living and laughing and loving. I just don't want to see it on a sign or a pillow.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, absolutely.
In everyone's living room. So,
although you know what about that, like when I think about that, when I was like a kid and in the bathroom of a friend's house and there was like a cross stitch of the Serenity Prayer, I now am like, was that kid's dad or
an alcoholic
sober? You know what I mean? Like I start to think like, yeah, that. Anyway, yeah. So patience, the tools that help you evaluate decisions,
but I think
and
like,
the Serenity Prayer.
Yeah. And like, just hopefully more awareness and hating myself less. Because I think I just used to spend more time wallowing in the mud pit of self, whatever, self-hate. So I think doing that less, not being more confident, because those things are not, like, one does not mean the other.
Right,
but like,
right.
You know, just unfortunately having more patience with myself and others has resulted. What's really interesting also, though, is like, I've also had, like, I had a friend break up within the past year that was pretty dramatic. Like painful, really painful. And then I had a romantic literal breakup after 6 years that was difficult because breakups are difficult. But not acrimonious or anything like it on the, in the scheme of things, it went about as well as it could have. But, you know, it has resulted in some tough conversations and some real whatever, but like those things as a symptom of being more curious and a more evolved person, I think are absolutely healthy. Like the fact that I feel the fact that I feel lonely a lot now because I moved to a place where I don't really know anybody and I'm making friends slowly because I am 38 and a weirdo and still get scared of going into public spaces with too many people because I learned to do that 3 years ago in a mass event that we all experienced is like, I have patience for being sad and lonely because I know that it's not permanent. Like I'm not suicidal because I'm not depressed because of those things. Like I am sad a lot and lonely a lot. And I don't feel the need to call my friends and be like the friends that I do have that are other places and be like, hey, I need you. Cause it's like, that's not whatever. But the people here that I'm meeting too, it's like, it's not a fun thing to be like, hey, I'm really lonely. Do you want to hang out?
You know, you have to approach it. You have to ease into,
But I guess, I guess what I'd say is I was a different person ever since 2020. You've probably never gotten that answer. I think because of therapy, that is what, if there's a dividing line, that's it. Where I just think about everything pretty differently now. Even the same situations, like I think about my relationship with my parents and my friends and myself and my place differently.
Well, the thing I was wondering was the way the patience plays out, and the patience with yourself makes sense. Cause I was like, okay, is it patience with like when a decision, when you're not sure if that friend breakup or the relationship breakup needs to happen, is it patience to sit on the feeling and let a bigger picture develop, see what happens, or is, but the patience with your own, the temporary nature of your own mental states makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And with other people, it's like, if I see, and I'm not kidding this time, if I see a sign that says live, laugh, love, there was a period of my life where I would have been like, this person is stupid. Like this person isn't worth my time. Or like I play in an orchestra. Sometimes people aren't great at what they're doing. I don't mean here in North Carolina Symphony, in case anyone's listening. I'm so sorry. But like, you know, I've played the violin for nearly 30 years. I've encountered people that are bad at what they're doing. And there was a long time where I just be like, okay, well, that person is worthless. Like they are choosing to be bad at the viola. And so they their life has no meaning to me. But I think, you know, you can really take that to such a dangerous extent of like making judgment calls about people's value and worth as if you are God.
And so I relate to this so much. Taking a judgment, taking it to the extreme.
Yeah.
Especially like because I value the creative thing I'm doing so much.
Yeah.
Because that it was like even right. And so not only judging someone I think is mediocre, which can be worse than terrible.
Yes.
But also someone who is a hobbyist rather than sees this as a vocation.
Yeah.
Now my risk is someone who is not doing this in a politically conscious manner as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like
not being on the edge.
Not doing it responsibly.
Yeah.
Doing it in a way where it's like, oh, really? You like did a voiceover commercial for the army? Like, that's not cool, dude. You know?
Right.
I say that not because of anyone I've observed, because those are the auditions, the voiceover auditions. There's like a short list of like, you know, organizations, totally. Companies that I won't. Anyway, the point being that there's any number of ways in which to judge a person and then really just level their entire life as
worthless. And, you know, I'm seeing a movie the other night and there's an advertisement for the National Guard that plays before it. And so my bit that I do is I'll sit there and shake my head theatrically so that somebody will see that, like, oh, that guy gets it. He's opposed to the militarization of society. Right. But it's like, you know, then somebody else, first of all, nobody saw me. that's the great lesson of life, is that nobody's actually paying attention to you. But somebody else could see me and be like, hey, I actually lost my dad in whatever war, and he was over there because he thought he was protecting us and me and whatever. It's like, I guess all that patience just goes toward everybody has a different experience and way of talking and way of thinking. And sometimes it's not worth writing somebody off because they voted for Trump, even though that's all I want to do. All I want to do is be like, not only should I write you off, you are a bad person. Like, there is evil in you because you voted for Trump. And it's like, it's just not true. It's almost always not true.
Right. And there are, whether they are at their core evil or not, there are people who are effectively permanently evil in the world because of their actions.
Well, Donald Trump is evil, but the people that vote for him are like, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even on the, for me to be like, who's spending my time around like communists and anarchists, like principled, like not hot topic anarchists, you know, to be like, oh, liberals are the enemy.
Right.
You know,
right.
To be like, everyone is on a journey and some people aren't even aware of a certain idea as, you know, which is not to tolerate the harm they do in the world,
but
to understand. And not even within your own mind, to be the kind of person who's constantly it does psychic damage to you to go, oh, bad at the viola, fuck you forever.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Or to hear somebody be like, I'm a liberal, and me be like, oh, you don't understand the difference between a liberal and a leftist. Like, you're just as bad as fucking, pick one.
Henry Kissinger.
Henry Kissinger. Yeah. You went with an older one. He's dead now, but I went with she's. So I guess, I don't know, there's this idea. I have a friend in Denver, and she and I talk about this stuff all the time, and she reads a ton of books about this, like, sort of like therapy aligned books, I guess. But like she at some point was reading something. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but he's a monk. I think he's written books about like anger and stuff. So she was reading
Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So she was reading one of his books, and talking about this concept, this very simple concept, that you have to think that everyone's out there doing their best. Like, if you don't assume and believe that everyone's doing their best, what's the point of being alive or interacting with other people, like being in society? And that is one of the hardest things to do. Like, when you see people behaving in a way that you think is bad, or that you disagree with, or that you think is immoral or evil or whatever, how are you possibly supposed to get to the point where you think they're trying their hardest, when it seems so clear that they're not, when it seems so clear that like they're trying to be bad, they're trying to be evil, they're trying to be bad at the viola. They know they're bad at conducting, and yet they continue to conduct this ensemble and put us through this misery. why don't they just go home? They must be unhappy too doing this. They know they're bad. It's like, they don't. They've got a different brain than me and a different world than I do.
Well, this is why my primary way of evaluating quality in Real Housewives is self-awareness.
Yeah. Yeah. But you
are they aware but that they're not? And this would be a much better way to end the conversation if we had recorded all the first hour of just talking about, yeah.
But you are making a judgment call about their self-awareness from the remove of you are a viewer watching through the television a series of clips that have been edited together of these people.
Yes, true. Of
like,
course.
And I would argue that I won't even qualify it. I would argue that it is impossible to judge how self-aware those people are being.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean,
I know. But like, that's the fun of watching it, is making judgment calls about that, or me thinking like, oh, that one's stupid, or that one's mean, or that one's evil. But like, and by one, I mean women. But like, but I think that's really interesting. And part of that, and part of all this like mental work of trying to get to a place of realizing that everyone is their own protagonist, and in their version of the world is trying the hardest that they can. It's like, it's super difficult.
The reason I value the self-awareness is because it feels like if someone sees their and others' actions clearly,
yeah,
they can make change if they're doing harm.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, sure, for sure. Or like apologize in a meaningful way.
Right.
Actually, yeah. Wait, can I say a specific one? I know we were talking before recording about specific housewives, but like one of the best, who was so good at apologizing this season on Salt Lake City? Was it Monica? Was she the one that was like genuinely like good at forming a series of sentences that were apologies that like on
that
paper,
might be the case. Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah.
If you read that apology on paper, you'd be like, she went to a class about how to apologize. Like,
right. That was good.
Like she didn't say I apologize if, or I'm sorry if, she just said like, I'm sorry that I did this thing and I'm sorry that I hurt your feelings.
Yes.
And I was
yes.
like, wow, how did she do that? And they would often then show a cutaway of one of those women in a talking head being like, wow, she's amazing at apologizing.
That's right. Yes. Okay. That I remember, but I don't remember who it was. I think it had to be Monica.
I think it was Monica. And it'd be like, yeah, she is good at apologizing because she's aware.
Yeah.
And doing her best in this ecosystem of people that are just like, you know, on the scale of self-interested to psychotic.
Right. And so what you're saying is that your coma of your therapy coma has turned you into a Monica. And that's what we should all be striving
is for. Realizing that the two-dimensional axis of self-interest on one end and psychosis, thank you, on the other, that there are more dimensions than those two dimensions. Like, it doesn't have to be you don't have to exist on that spectrum. You can't help but exist on that spectrum, but you can also exist on spectrums of patience and kindness and love and empathy and all those other things.
That's Chris. Thanks for listening. I really appreciate it. Go to the links in the show notes to hear more of Chris's music, especially with Fubutsushi, to support this show, especially via Patreon, and tell your friends. There are so many people for whom this show would be just what they want. And to be honest, that's on you to help find them and tell them about it. And until next week, remember, you are a mist.